for about an hour. Well, let's start off, Emmett. One of the things I try to do is to take you back as far as you can remember, and I start with your grandparents, things that they may have shared with you that you can remember. That means in this interview we're trying to go back as far as you can recollect, and I'll ask you first about your grandparents. Where did they come from, both mother and father?
Basically, from my knowledge, is they came from South Carolina and migrated to West Palm Beach. So between West Palm Beach and South Carolina, that's about as much of a history that I know about.
Now, was this on your mother's side or your father's side?
Mother and on my grandmother's side, on my mother's side.
Okay.
Fortunately, I have my grandfather's last name.
Okay.
My mother was in 11th grade.
Okay.
When she, 12th grade, and she got pregnant with me, and she had to drop out of school.
Okay.
And I took her name.
Yeah. Now, wait, we're talking about your grandparents now.
I took my grandparent name. I had that was how I got his name.
Okay.
Right.
I see. Okay.
I vaguely remember him.
Okay.
And just from with the family, I know when we go to South Carolina, Sumter, South Carolina.
Sumter, okay.
I'm pretty much sure it's on my granddaddy's side.
Okay, okay.
Between West Palm Beach and Sumter, South Carolina.
Okay.
And I don't know whether both of them came from South Carolina and West Palm Beach or...
okay.
I'm just not that we never had a chance to discuss, like I said, because they never were into my life.
Okay, so you really personally don't remember too much about them.
I don't remember anything about my grandmother at all, but my granddaddy, I vaguely remember him being a fireman out to the old McHaddon mill, the fogey plant out there.
Okay, okay.
I vaguely remember that.
Okay.
And of course I remember his brother, which was my uncle.
Okay.
What
can you tell me about your uncle?
Uncle Ben was a man of stature. He was a very hard worker. He worked at the old phosphate plant over there where Rainier is now, near Rainier.
Okay. The phosphate plant?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Yeah, okay.
Used to be over there.
Okay.
I remember used to take him to lunch, and the most enjoyable part about that was the truck that we call it left, and after he finished his lunch, he always would leave us a little something.
Chuck, you called it?
We call it the Chuck.
Okay. I've never heard that word before.
He used to call it the Chuck. And
okay.
It was what was left over. They'd always leave us, not straps, but leave us something.
Yeah.
And,
okay.
Of course, Aunt Nellie would always put a little extra in there.
Yeah.
For this purpose. And it was a way that they could get the distance from, and we lived out there where the baseball park is now.
Oh, yeah?
Okay. Division Street.
Okay.
I was on Division Street, just the street over from where Frieda lived. I'm right in that neighborhood.
Okay.
So Frieda House, then Trey Eyes on the other side.
Yes.
Two blocks down, that was my home.
Okay, and you were related to Henry, too, weren't you?
Yes, uh-huh.
Yeah, okay.
His wife and I were two sisters' children.
Okay, all right.
And out in just down a little further, we used to call it Sandersville. And that's where Uncle Ben used to live and Aunt Nellie. And I used to walk from generally that area to where Rainier is now.
Okay, Sandersville, Sandersville.
Mm-hmm, Sandersville.
Okay. It sounds as if you might have been closer to your uncle than your grand...
Well, that's because he was alive, you know. And,
okay.
And that was on my... he was the closest one to me. And
okay.
His name was Ben Coakley, and of course I was Emmett Coakley because I took my granddaddy's last name.
Okay, okay. All right. Did you ever hear your uncle talk about, I'm trying to see how far back I can go, about the Civil War or slavery or Reconstruction, any of these things? You remember any?
No, not really.
Did he try what we're trying with young James here to, you know, talk about some of these things to help educate you about the past?
No, because I tell you what, I think was what really took precedent during that time in my life was that the World War One.
Okay.
So the emphasis was on World War One.
Okay.
Uncle Munchie and Uncle George and all those people had been into participating in World War One.
Okay.
So then that would sort of, that's the era that was okay. most discussed at that yeah. time.
That's about as far back as we can reach
Right, uh-huh, right.
Can you remember things they may have told you about World War One and African-American involvement, problems, fun things?
Pretty much what is traditionally known about the way they were treated.
Can you help me with that a little bit?
It's the discrimination thing, but I guess when during that time, it was so accepted, it was a way of life.
Okay.
Until, in reality, it really didn't make much difference, because they knew the role that they were going to play. They were going to be cooks and they're going to be truck drivers.
Okay.
You know.
Yeah.
They were going to. They weren't necessarily was going to be sort of like they did things like was normally with the housekeeper for the regular Caucasian soldier.
Okay.
This is the type of thing. Some of the type of thing.
Yeah.
And where the horses were, they maintained the stables, yeah. that was their job.
Yeah.
That was the minority's job. And of course they had a chance to grow up into the ranks, and many of them did. I can't name any specific part of the war there's some they did some made some contribution to the war, World War One during that time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, your comments are interesting, and they're very compatible with what others are saying.
Yeah.
There was an acceptance, and I've heard the term, they knew their place.
That's it.
And I guess it took the beginning of the resistance, if you will, was the Rosa Parks thing, and of course the NAACP started in 1909, but it took a while before African Americans just became tired of being subservient. In that era you're talking about, it was just the way it was, I guess.
Yeah. And I mentioned, ironically, we were talking about the wars, because then, you know, in World War II, you had basically some of the same things, but their duties and role had extended, had been expanded some.
Yeah.
You still knew your place.
Yeah.
But it had been expanded, and they were allowed to do other things, and allowed that they had showed mechanical skills, then they could do mechanical skills. If they showed electronics, they were able to do that then. And if they were allowed to be master sergeants and quartermaster, who were supervising all of the equipment and things like that, the role increased a little bit, and they were in their own. That's when in the World War II they were able to have their own lieutenant. And he did that through the field. He came up through the ranks, basically, because there wasn't any schools for that during that time.
Maybe the Tuskegee Airmen are a great example of that.
They
were great flyers, and the bomber pilots used to ask for them to be their escorts.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
And I use that because that's where we begin to recognize if we were good enough to go to war.
Yes.
Why aren't we good enough to go in the drugstore?
That's right.
And stand at any place we want to go.
That's right.
That's where that realization come in, and we begin to man it a little more.
Yeah. I think it was Truman who finally integrated the armed forces during the Korean War.
Right, right.
And that was another step forward.
Right, right.
Okay. Do you remember how your uncle and your grandparents earned a living back in those days?
Yes. Like I said, I was very fortunate that my granddaddy was a skilled fireman. And my uncle, I'm not sure what Uncle Ben did, but he did it for a long period of time.
Okay.
The docks were always there.
Okay.
The fishing industry was always there. And if you didn't make it, if you were able to get out of the fishing industry, then you went into whatever else was available.
Okay.
And the Falfaith plant, along with shortly the Falfaith plant, then Container came in.
Okay.
My dad worked at Container first, then he transferred to Rainier.
Okay.
And he retired from Rainier after 42 years.
Okay. Did you ever know Captain Frink, Neil's
yes,
dad?
Yes.
Did you?
Yes.
Okay.
See, my father was one of the captain of one of the boats that would come in on the season about the time that Captain Frink was
okay.
was down there.
This is the pogey season
pogey
you're talking
season,
about?
Pogey season, yes, uh-huh.
Okay.
And that's how I got to see my mother, met him, and when
okay.
the season was over, he was gone.
Okay,
and then
all right.
That's it.
Okay. We'll come back to your parents in a minute,
okay.
but that's
right.
interesting.
Uh-huh.
Well, your uncle and your grandfather made pretty good money for those in those days.
As journalists, they provided a good life for their families.
Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Do you happen to know? This is probably going too far back. Did your grandmother make clothes for the family, or did they buy clothes? What was
they? They made clothes and they bought clothes.
They both. Okay. Okay.
I used to hear my mama say what the clothes that her mama used to make for her.
Okay.
And there was said my mother sewed real well.
Okay.
My mother did, but she picked
yeah.
up from her.
From her mother.
Mother.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
One of the things I wanted to ask you here was back. Have you seen Rosewood? The film Rosewood.
Yes, I've seen it.
You know all the trauma that was there.
Right.
One of the problems in that particular era, which is just after World War I, was lynching and what they call convict leasing.
Mm-hmm.
Convict leasing, I'll define briefly, if a turpentine company needed some labor, they would go to the local sheriff or police and they would buy prisoners from the sheriff
mm-hmm.
and they would work them in the turpentine business or the lumber business, and they'd pay the sheriff for that help that they got. And it was called convict leasing, and it was worse than slavery. They would work these poor people almost to death, and then they'd give them back to the sheriff and say, this guy can't work anymore, what have you. Did you ever hear your uncle or your grandfather or people that lived back in that era talk about lynching or convict
oh, yes.
leasing?
Uh-huh.
Or can
How
you
about the lynching? But not about
convict leasing is
yeah.
new to you. Or,
it's
yeah,
that's
okay.
relatively new
yeah.
because it's about the time that I came along. The CC camp
okay.
was an operator, which was a little different. From,
yes, and
a little different twist. It was
a legal way to provide labor.
Provide
yeah.
the labor
and
rather
got,
than
yeah.
the
convict leasing.
Convict
yeah.
leasing was.
What do you remember them talking to you about as far as lynching is concerned? Do you have any memories of these discussions?
I think that the lynching was basically not specifically for in the Nassau County area, but that was happening over nationwide in the Mississippi
okay.
area where we're lynching,
okay.
you know, that area where
yeah.
lynching would occur. But just per se, I know of them talking about being beaten by groups of whites, but and
yeah.
here again, I don't know whether you noticed, but I've always found this, that in Fernandina Beach, in Nassau County in general, because I left Fernandina and came out here.
Okay.
And if you knew your place, you pretty much was treated.
You were okay.
Like
you were okay.
Like you was expected to be
yeah,
treated.
Okay.
That's one thing. If you didn't, now you had to suffer the consequences.
Yes, I see.
And of course, I do know that the sheriff's department was rough on blacks. Then that's another thing that they were rough, period.
Yeah.
They didn't care who you were,
black
or white.
Yeah.
They were rough. But naturally, if it was a black, It was because it was there's prejudice in it.
Yeah.
But you can never, and that's one of the things I guess you'll find that as we talk, that I've been always been able to look on the other side of the coin. And I think that's, you're going to find some real historical things later on as you go through this interview. But not far as that, the mention, I can't remember where, I'm sure it happened, of some incidents where somebody mysteriously turned up missing, but just to say that at out here at Sultana Drive out here, that somebody was lynched out there in 1914. I don't recall anything like that.
Okay. We'll come back to that. I want to talk about Sheriff Youngblood and so forth. And incidentally, someone that I interviewed not too long ago told me that Alice Youngblood is still alive and lives out this way. Do you?
Yes, his wife.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
She lives out at Hilliard up here. At a farm up there.
I'll see if I can't track her down. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you, I'm coming back now to your uncle and your grandparents.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember any of them having black newspapers to read? And if so, where did they come from? Where were they published?
The only one that I can remember back there during that time was the Pittsburgh Courier, which was the black paper that was published weekly. And of course, baseball was a very popular sport around the county area. That was something we could play that didn't cost us much.
Yeah.
Cost them much, and they played ball, and they took a lot of pride in it. And the Pittsburgh Courier would carry pretty much all of the sports that was happening around the nation.
Okay.
And of course, that at that time, we had some ties at Buck Leonard had some relatives in Ferndina, was relatives to the Peck family. I'm sure you heard that name before.
Yes, I have.
And they would come down during the summer, so they were playing with the Chicago, gosh, can't think of those
teams. White Sox?
No, not the White Sox. It's all
black.
All black. All black teams.
Yeah, okay.
And Josh Gibson and
those
names like that was names that in that area that my parents would, those were the baseball heroes at that time.
Okay.
Prior to the Jackie Robinson and the Hank Aaron.
Okay. Did they cover, was the Pittsburgh Courier a black newspaper?
It was a black newspaper.
Okay.
It covered all of the things that happened in the lynchings that you would have, all that was there. And it had the entertainers, that's where you could keep a tab on your black entertainers because they weren't coming this far. Well, I can't say these because they did come to Jacksonville like they do in that time. Matter of fact, I was just reading an article the other day with the old Ritz Theater where a lot of them used to come and was put up there and had a place that there was preserving over there in the Springfield area.
Until Flagler took his railroad south, most people stopped in the North Florida area.
Right.
And Miami really didn't open up till the 20s, so All right. Let's talk about your parents then. Where did they come from?
Okay, well, my mother is from Ferndina Beach.
Okay, she was born there.
My biological daddy was from Beaufort, North Carolina.
Okay.
He was...
is that B-E-A-U-F-O-R-T?
B-E-A-U-F-O-R-T.
I get those two mixed up.
Beaufort and Beaufort.
Yeah, okay.
He was one of those, what you call North Carolina Geeches.
Geeches? How do you spell that?
Now, that's a good question.
We'll just take a...
G-E-E-C-H-S,
maybe?
It's just C-H-E.
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 G-E-E-C-H-E. Okay, James, thank you. Okay. Now, did they, just to follow that for a minute, were they the ones that spoke Gullah language?
Yeah, man, I see you later, you know.
Yeah, okay.
I'm glad to see you. Come to my house and I take good care of you.
Yeah, okay. Was that an offshoot of Gullah?
Yeah, it's a Gullah because it's African, because you know that this is you know, Hilton Head, South Carolina. The story about Hilton Head, where the group of Africans landed there.
Yes, okay.
And Savannah out in that area, and Charleston around in there.
Yeah, okay.
So up that coast there, pretty much.
So he came down from there and met your mother.
The season, they had different seasons.
Oh, he was a pogey fisherman.
He was a pogey fisherman.
Okay.
And they would come down to Ferndina during the season when the Menhaden was running.
Okay.
And they'd leave there and they'd go back to Nantucket. The Red Bank, New Jersey. They'd go back into out to Louisiana. They even go out into Texas.
Okay.
Smith Meal, he worked for Smith Meal. And they had these companies wherever the Menhaden was running, that's where the season would be.
Okay.
And they used to come in, you know, there used to be three mills down at one time. And you had, each one of them had a fleet of away from 10 to 12 boats.
Okay.
So you had 36 to 48. Those big, well, they wasn't big during that time, they were very small, but now the big ones, that they went from the wood to the aluminum bottom boats.
Yeah.
But then my, and that's how that's, and then like I said, she was in 12th grade, and that the rule was then you had to drop out of school when you got pregnant. So
I was living,
she was living at home.
Okay, well, he was on a pogey boat that was based somewhere else, but he came into Fernandina, is that right? Or
the boat would dock, they would unload out there at Old Town.
But
the boat would come up to and dock downtown.
Okay.
Downtown.
Yeah.
North of the marina.
Uh-huh.
Down that area down there.
But his boat was stationed in Fernandina, is that right?
No, his boat was not stationed. He was just here for a season.
I see. Okay.
When the season was over, they would go on back.
Whatever.
The boat and all would go back.
I see. Okay. Right. But there were some boats that were stationed here, though.
Yeah, some with the fish the year round.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay. Like Captain Frank's boat.
Well, see, Captain Frank, that was like a long time after. That was after the big run on the Menhaden. And you could, and it was, in other words, what I'm saying is those fish ran in school, you know, with 48 boats out there. You didn't have that when Captain Frank was. You had maybe like five boats or six boats.
Yeah, I see.
So you could fish the rear around. You could find your school of Menhaden.
But, I see.
But before it was so many, it would be very difficult to stay the whole year around.
I see.
So you had to go where they were in abundance.
Where they were.
Right.
Now your daddy then was here for the season, and he met your mother, and you were conceived. And did he go on off? Did they marry?
No, they never married.
They never married, and you really then don't know your father.
I only know him by the fact that him coming in at I think from a monetary guy. I think he gave me an overcoat and a bicycle.
Yeah,
that's the only thing he's ever given me from a monetary.
Okay.
As far as raising my mother.
She
raised me until I was 6 years old, and then she married my stepfather.
I see. Okay. Well, now we'll come to that's good. That cleared up that. Okay. So I was going to ask, where did they meet, court, and marry? Well, they never did. They kind of, you know, they courted, and you were born.
Right.
And okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about your stepfather and your mother. What was his occupation?
Okay, my stepfather came from Millen, Georgia. He was a Georgia boy.
Millen, M-I-L-L-E-N?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Millen, Georgia, and he came here with the CC camp.
Okay.
And they, my mom, she had several sisters, Lula, and Carrie, Willie, and Ella, and Bertha.
She had a bunch of sisters.
Yes, she did. And Aunt Lula and my mama met two of the men who came to the CC camp. Matter of fact, Uncle Clarence was right next door to Henry.
I see.
That's the old man that's there in the yard and joined the property back there.
Okay.
And then on the other side of him was my daddy's house. So,
your stepdaddy's
house. My stepdaddy.
Yeah, you called him daddy because he really
was. Oh, yeah. He was my daddy. He was the guy that got me where I'm at today.
Yeah.
And they got married when I was 6 years old. I think it was something like July the 31st, 1938.
I'm going to come back to those dates in a minute and write them down.
Okay.
And That's a wonderful thought you have for him, because even though he wasn't your biological father, he was your daddy.
Oh, he was my daddy.
He was your daddy. And I think that's wonderful.
He got me started.
And did we talk about what he did?
Oh, he was, at that time, after the CC camp, he got to work, worked on the wood yard at Container.
Okay.
He transferred from Container, or at least he left Container and went to Rainier. And he went to Rainier, he worked on the, in the acid plant of the mill, where they would take the big limestone and the sulfur and combine it into make the acid that used to process the paper.
Okay.
And he had very illiterate at the time, but he was sort of self-educated himself as time progressed.
Okay.
He learned to read the paper, he learned to read the Bible, he learned to do so much. It was amazing that he ended up retiring from Container, working in the lab, laboring different specimens.
Okay.
So he'd go around and collect the specimens, come back, label them, test them, and run them.
Okay.
He worked with C.T. Smith for a long time.
Is a wonderful guy. Okay, I'll have to ask C.T. about your dad.
Yeah, you're asking.
C.T. and I are on the vestry at St. Peter's together.
Yeah. Okay.
And I knew Ruth very well.
Right.
Until we lost her. Did your stepdad make enough money to keep all of you comfortable?
Well, he did. He did work real hard. My mother had a, during that time among the blacks, any form of disease that could not be cured with a pill or a tablet. We really didn't know what they all were during that time.
Yeah.
My mother had a misery in her stomach that I'm not so sure that it just took a long time for them to discover it. And I was in 12th grade before she had it, the operation to correct that. And during that time, it was a very difficult time for me, but I was able to make it through because she couldn't do any heavy lifting and washing. And Rainier required the employees to have a khaki uniform.
I see.
With the Rainier on it in the name.
Yeah, okay.
And you had to maintain them yourself, so I had to wash the khakis in the ballpark, out of the ballpark.
You're still doing the laundry.
I mean, out of the ballpark into the rub tub. Rub it back into the ballpark, rinse it out, and the last water was a blue-in water. And then starch it. And, I can remember in 1950, Peck High had, which was the all-black school, Peck High had his first football team in 1950. And I was the co-captain of that team.
Wonderful.
And I had to go home and do for Mama. So Mama would have his supper and everything ready. And then go back to football practice.
Did
but like I said, he self-learned, and then he retired after 42 years of training.
How about your mama's education?
Mama finished the 12th grade. She went back and got a GED.
That's from Peck?
No, the GED was sometime after.
But she finished the 12th grade at Peck?
No, she was in 12th grade.
Oh, I see.
But you after once you not like it is now, they have all of the little classes for expected young kids to go. She had to drop out of school, so she didn't finish 12th grade. Then she finished it later on. She took a GED.
Got a GED, right? Okay.
And she worked at the. Prior to that, she did a lot of washing and ironing for a lot of the permanent families around there. She did. House cleaning and washing for Martha Hippert, who used to, heard that name before.
Yes, the Hippert restaurant or bar downtown.
She used to wash for them and take care of Mr. Did that even Miss Martha got down sick and moved out to the beach up, American Beach.
Okay.
And she also did washing for John T. Ferrer.
Okay.
And she babysit McLean, Dr. McLean.
Oh, yeah, sure.
The children, the twins.
Those
were her babies.
McLean Stubitz, or one of the eye doctors.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
All right.
Did you...
Then she got a job working as a cafeteria employee at for the school board of Nassau County. That's where she retired from.
Okay. Then the surgery helped her overcome her misery, so everything was okay there.
Right. Mm-hmm.
during that period, I guess you worked to earn a little money too, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I worked down on the docks for the Harry Solomon Fish Company for 25 cents an hour after school.
I see, okay.
And I worked there, and on Saturdays, I had the distinction of going up to the house. It's a, I don't think they own it now, but it is a historical site, the Solomon House is. And it's the La Palma.
Oh, La Palma.
The La Palma.
Yeah.
That's the house.
Yeah, okay.
And I used to whack those floors in there. They were beautiful. They stained floors. I used to wax those floors. Oh. And that's my job on Saturday.
Okay. Now, did you give the money to your parents, or were you allowed to keep it?
I was allowed to give, and then I was allowed to keep pretty much. Because
okay. Sid
Porter got me into the movie and got me a bag of popcorn and a popsicle and, you know, okay. 10 cents to get in. Yeah.
Can we talk about the movie for a minute? That was a segregated movie?
Yeah, we had to go upstairs.
Okay.
Yeah, we had to go upstairs. We were sitting upstairs, go around the side, buy a ticket around the side. And
did the whites buy it in the front?
And buy in the front. They were in the front. We were out on the side. Yeah.
Did you have restrooms upstairs?
The restrooms were downstairs. They were separated.
It was a colored and white type of thing. Mm-hmm. Were there ever any problems there between the kids?
No problems. Basically, no problem. Even when they integrated, it wasn't any problem.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Everybody knew their place.
And you know, it's you up above them, and it's probably the most dangerous thing anyway. They were all white now that we all black up above them. I'd much rather, you know, I'm glad it was that way around. We did have that leverage rather than being up there, being down there, and there being up.
Yeah. Okay.
But then when it did change, it didn't. There weren't any major problems then.
Okay. All right. Let's see, were there any concerns that your stepdaddy and your mother talked to you about relative to race relations, problems, things you should or shouldn't do? What kind of discussions did you
have? Traditionally, here again, you know, I pretty much was an obedient child, and I knew where my rims were, and I didn't want to go places.
Did they help you understand?
Oh, yes, they understood.
For example, we talked to James this morning
about
the N-word.
Yeah, they helped me understand that there's something you just don't do.
Yeah. Do you?
And see at the courthouse, whether anybody was looking or not. And we were devilish. We didn't catch anybody just to see if the water really was cold over there, you know, at the white only.
Okay.
Colored only. That was the word colored then. We weren't black yet.
Yeah.
And we weren't Afro-American then.
Yeah.
We were still colored.
Yeah, okay.
And they had the sign there. And we would go through there, and we'd hit that water and see if it was cold and take the hand.
The white fountain?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
To be sure to see if it was cold.
Yeah.
It was cold.
Yeah, okay.
And then in the bathrooms, there was a difference because they were right on the side. But occasionally, theirs would be left over. You could look in there and see. We had the old chain with the tank above
and
you pull the
chain,
and the water come down.
Yeah.
And it was all rusted and corroded.
And the white or the...
And the black side.
And the colored side.
And the white side, you could see the porcelain sinks, you see.
So, in effect, they didn't take very good care of the colored side.
No, it didn't. Yeah, no, and okay. I assume that naturally we didn't do much taking care of it ourselves either,
see. Yeah, okay, Well, that's it.
And going downtown there to Lockwood Drugstore, if I can remember. All right.
That's one I haven't heard of.
Walsh was pretty much, I never went there because I had a sense of feeling of the prejudice
okay.
But in Lockwood, because I know why that's true, because my Uncle Ben, there's an Emmett L. Copley that was in Ferndale, and he called him Bubba Copley.
Bubba Copley.
He worked at the post office.
Okay.
He was sort of like the black mayor before they got the elected mayor.
You looked up to him as a leader of the blacks in the community?
Well, they did. Everyone did.
Yeah.
Even though I didn't spend that much time, because after high school I was gone. But he was just that. He's down. He worked his way up from Lockwood. He used to work at the drugstore as a porter there, cleaning for them, and then he had the job at the post office. One of the first to go to the post office.
back on record now. Was anyone in your mother or your stepfather's family in the military?
Stepfather was.
Stepfather was in the military?
World War II.
Okay.
Yeah, he served in Germany.
Okay.
He was in the Quartermaster Division. Drove a truck. I've had quite a few experiences there. It was over there at the time that things were really wrapping up. 42, 43. He was able to save enough money, send enough money home.
That helped.
My mother was able to save, and when he came home, she was able to build a home right across the way it is now. Built that house from scratch there.
And what's the address of that house?
227 South Division Street.
South Division, okay. Oh, God, buy and take.
Yeah, I sold that house.
Okay.
Got a lot of azaleas that he planted.
Okay.
There.
Oh, they're probably pretty right now.
Well, we built that house while he was in the military.
Okay.
Robert Myers built that house.
Okay. Did you ever hear him talk about any experiences that relate to racial
together? Yeah, again, like I said, they had a little wider choice of
World War II,
but yeah. The prejudice was there.
Still there.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he would often tell about, at this time, the realization was coming that, hey, because of the color of my skin, I'm still human. There were many of them. I think I can recall some pictures. I don't know, some of his stuff got away from me.
Yeah.
I gave a lot of it to my son.
Yeah.
So when I remarried again, it was like I tried to give my son as much of his mama, and that was among some of the stuff, things that I gave, and his grandparents. That's my grandfather and grandmother over there, behind the light there.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yeah. All right. I'll look at that.
Anyway, he would talk about how he had some friends, some white friends. As a matter of fact, he had some pictures where they were taken together.
Yeah, okay.
This is the time it was sort of warming up a little bit, that, you know,
we could
share our concern and our fear of each other, but when we got ready to go, certain things just to go your way.
I understand, right. Okay. And it took the Korean War and President Truman to really open that up,
right.
Okay. Talk a little bit about, is your mother or stepfather still alive?
No, they both are dead.
Just a couple of things you remember about them, you get along with them.
I was blessed to have a stepfather like my stepfather. He was
a good man,
he was concerned about me. I remember the day he kept telling me we had an accident on the ice truck, used to come by every day.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they had to block ice there, and the young man up on the hill over there gotten killed because he was back behind the truck, and the driver didn't know he was back there getting the little chips of ice off the truck, and he got killed. And so it was a no-no, you didn't run behind the ice truck.
Yeah.
And of course, I thought my daddy was going to work that day, and I came from around that house, and I got the little ice, you know, when you chip it caught off, and then as it melt, the little thing come out, looked like a little popsicle, you know. And I saw my chance to get mine. I ran out there, and when Jerris, as I got back, he said, "Come here, boy." I could have died. I had no idea my daddy was home. And he took me and he paddled me.
Uh-huh.
And then he found out that somehow an 8-pin, just a little, where he had the little 8-well, and no, the 8 was just a 8-pin had a cap, it wasn't, you had to dip it into the 8, but he saw it up on the dresser, and he knew that we didn't have anything that around my house, so it had to come from somewhere else.
Yeah.
And he also, I didn't know he knew this, but I told him I bought it. I said, "Yeah, you bought it with my change off my dresser." And that was a no-no. Okay, how much change you see? You ask for what you want.
Yeah.
So those are the only two whippings he ever gave me.
Okay.
And at the end of when I graduated, I had very small schools. It didn't cost much. It cost me $300 a year the first year to go to Bethune-Cookman in 1950.
Okay.
But by the time I graduated in 1954, it was much more
than
that.
Expensive, yeah.
But I graduated and I came home one day. I had a scholarship to Bethune, had one to Savannah State and Ed Waters. The one at Bethune-Cookman was a part scholarship for $150 for football and $150 for choir, singing in the choir. So I came home and he told me, said, well, you got a telegram in it from the coach down at Bethune-Cookman, said, report Monday. I said, no, Daddy, I said, I don't think I'll be going. He said, oh yeah, you're going. He said, well, let me put it this way. He said, you're going somewhere, or you're going to leave here. Those were his words. Mm-hmm. So, Old Town, we used to walk it, and I didn't have no bicycle, didn't have no car, and my girlfriend was out there, which was Henry's first cousin.
Okay.
Frieda's brother's daughter.
Okay.
And I walked out there, and of course, we'd been together. She came from the Catholic school, and we'd been together from 8th grade to 12th grade, and we were very close. I went to the movie, she went to the movie. I didn't go, she didn't go. That's just the way it was. Anyway, we went out there, and I told her what happened, and I left that night, until I had to go, in my mind, I knew I wasn't ready to leave home. I was, I had a good home, and I wasn't about to leave that. So I went on to school, and that's how I got, came back. I worked at Container one summer. I went to a Container two summers, one at on the wood yard, throwing 12 wood.
Okay.
And I worked at the George G. Archer Company the second year. Okay. And my daddy got me that job because both of those jobs. Okay. And I went up to Amagansett, Long Island, New York to work at the Pogey plant with my aunt. And then the next year I worked right at home.
Okay.
But he laid the groundwork by telling me that I had to go somewhere else, and he
cared, and he wanted you to do what was right.
Said he started while he was in the military, he learned how to cut hair.
Okay.
And he used to cut mine, and all the kids used to see. They liked the way he used to tape it up, and all.
Yeah.
And he started doing that. So in the backyard, he had a little shed out there he built, and on Saturdays and Sundays, and when he was away from Rennie, he started cutting hair.
And did he charge the kids or do it for
them? Yeah, he charged them. It was about 50 cent, dollar, or less than that. Then he started to expand, and he opened up the Blue Moon Barber Shop.
Okay.
There, what is that? Catches on.
I know what you mean. Yeah. I can't think of
that. That's not open. There used to be a service station on the corner, and the Blue Moon was right there.
Yeah.
And he cut hair that the whole time he was there. He cut hair the whole time I was in school, long time before. That's how he got me through school, in addition.
Okay.
So he tells the story. I got a video. And in my retirement, my nephews made a video of it. They interviewed Henry and my aunts over there in Ferndina, and my daddy was telling about how the people at the mill were asking to Joe, how you gonna pay that boy away to school? And he used to tell them about how he used to come on Saturday nights and count them pennies up and quarters and nickels, cutting hair and get that money ready to send down there.
He was a good man, wasn't he?
He was a good man, very good man.
Talk a little bit about your memories of your mom.
Mom was always hardcore. When I say hardcore, she's always challenging. And, you wasn't gonna get by nothing but mom.
Yeah.
And to be sure she kept you on alert, whether you did it or not, she'd make it sound just like you're still doing it.
Yeah.
She's a very good cook. She used to crochet, she used to sew, she used to make quilts, she made, this is some of her work here.
Yeah, okay.
And she used to, in her later years when she, after she stopped working, she retired, and she used to make cakes. She just every time somebody had a wedding, a funeral, a birthday, she had one of those mixes, big portable mixes,
Yeah.
She was known for good cakes, pound cakes, and crochet and making things, different things. That was her livelihood. She used to do it to 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning. Papa Joe sit over there in this chair, and she sit in this chair. Well, not what I'm saying, but at their home. They would sit there. They're very compatible. They'd argue and fuss, but they never fought. And
there was a lot of love for you kids there then. But
yeah,
but she was.
Oh yeah,
you want to see that you learned.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, and she was always challenging me. And she, unfortunate, none of the girlfriends that I really wanted, she didn't care too much for them, of course. And then my first wife, which I met here in Callahan, which was 5 years older than me, and I think that she had the inside track by being a little older. Okay. James, check out there.
Okay. You want me to turn this off a little?
You can handle it.
Okay.
James.
I'm going to...
Good point.
Let's...
go ahead.
It looks like you had two loving parents who cared about you, is what it adds up to. Okay. What did you all do as a family in your leisure time, if you had any?
Oh, well, I was always busy with school activities, the Boy Scouts, and we were always close to the church. Always have been close to the church.
Did you do things as a family? Did you go places?
As you look back then during the time when I was at home, there wasn't too many places to really go. And of course, there was always the forever American beach, but we went to St. Augustine on trips like that, went to Millen, Georgia together. We did trips together.
Did you have a family car or some sort?
Yes, uh-huh.
Okay.
We did.
That helped a lot.
It helped a lot, now, we didn't get that until after I had, during the time I was in school.
Okay.
Yeah, he bought him it must be, it was 1949 Lincoln.
Okay.
It was old, but it would go.
It would go.
Yeah. And,
How about church, Emmett? Where did you go to church?
I was raised in that church, First Baptist Church, Missionary Church.
Okay.
I was baptized in that church. That was our church home.
You all went to church as a family?
Went to church as a family. He was a deacon at Missionary Baptist Church.
I'm going to ask you later about brothers and sisters and ages and so forth, but did you have brothers and sisters?
I don't have any.
So your stepmother, stepfather and mother never had any children?
Never had any children,
Okay, all right. Did they vote?
Yes, my father was very active, and my mother. My father was very active when everything opened up. He was very active and supportive of getting people to vote.
You say open up when they could vote without a lot of harassment?
Right, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Prior to that time, they had literacy tests and so forth. Did those keep them from voting for a while? Do you remember?
I don't think they really cared at that time. It was just that at a later time, and here again you hear me refer back to the war because that's what I remember, that these men left and women had to struggle, so while they were gone, do jobs, peacetime jobs, wartime jobs that they wouldn't have done in peacetime, they couldn't do. And that was, began to gain a little more insights, things just don't have to be this way, Why are they this way? Begin to get inquisitive about why are they this way and begin to do something about it.
When they started to vote, then the impediments had been removed, you think?
Well, you still
poll taxes,
you still had people saying that the skepticism that if I work for Mr. Van Zandt he would tell me who to vote, and even though he may not, whether he could have found out who you voted for or not, you were afraid to vote, this type of thing.
I was thinking about the right to vote.
The right to vote.
Yeah, the impediments, literacy tests and poll tax, and did your mother and stepfather bump into any of that, or?
I don't recall.
Yeah, okay.
I don't recall.
So when they were ready to vote, it was okay.
That's right. It was okay, except the fact that those who were illiterate and couldn't read the ballots, and that was, and you didn't trust who was going to be helping assist that person when they go in there.
How did that work then? How did it?
They had a poster to go in there with them.
Would that be a black person?
No.
Oh, okay.
Unless, now, not at that time it did, but now it could be.
Yeah,
I see. Could well be because they have black posters working at the polls, see.
Were those posters fairly honest? I mean, would they...
I would say they were fairly honest, they still had a certain amount of integrity to maintain.
Yeah.
We don't want to come out and say, you know, O'Brien told me to vote for Emmett, and, you know, I didn't want to vote for Emmett, you know?
Yeah.
It's not, they didn't want to prepare for that. And, of course, whether you say, oh, he's just lying, well, you know, and if Brian did that two or three times,
yeah,
then it ceased to be a lie then because there's some consistency in
that's right.
And what's happening.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. How about health care? You mentioned your mother had a stomach problem. Where did the family go for health care?
Well, it's just the three. Fernandina. The Brewster's Hospital in Jacksonville was the hospital for the blacks.
Okay. Okay.
That was where we met. You knew you was going to Brewster's.
Okay.
And it was a very good hospital.
Okay.
Many of it was noted for its prenatal care.
Okay.
For blacks, those that didn't, that the midwives didn't take care of, went to Brewster's Hospital.
Okay.
And then later on, when the Nassau Hospital was built over there on 14th Street, then they had the, you know, the black had a wing there.
Was that Dr. Humphreys?
Okay, Dr. Humphreys.
Okay.
Humphreys. Now, Dr. Langenhausen was my doctor. And
was
my,
he white?
Yes, uh-huh.
Can we spell that name?
Langenhauser? Langenhauser.
Okay, she can pick that up.
Yeah, huh?
Okay.
Dr. Humphreys was my mama doctor.
Okay. She liked him?
Oh, yes. He was Dr. Langenhauser's, and matter of fact, I tell you the truth. Out of all the doctors I can recall, as far back as I can, Dr. Humphreys happened to be the one that I mean, Dr. Snelling, and Dr. Langenhauser.
Snelling, S-N-E-L-L-I-N-G?
Yes, uh-huh.
Okay.
And then you had both of the Dickens, Ben, and then Richard Dickens. And then you had, the only one that I ever heard anybody that had any, that I had any problem with was Dr. Britton.
Britt.
Yeah, he
was the one that was murdered.
Yeah, he was. He sure was. And I had a problem with him the night I was with my friend down here when he got shot. And when we got over there, he was on call at that at the hospital. Of course, we had to go in the back. CT had to come. But we couldn't go in the rescue.
Yeah, okay.
I had to take him over there.
Okay.
But when we got there, then CT them had to go get what they had was the best thing then, where I think they had a station wagon to transport them to
Dr. Britton's office
from the hospital to Jacksonville.
I
had
see.
To be transferred.
Okay.
And he was there, and he did not want to do anything for that man because he wasn't drunk, that he was drunk. And he had a habit of being using the N-word.
Dr. Britton.
Dr. Britton,
Who shot him, by the way? The gentleman that was shot?
Yeah. His brother-in-law.
The brother-in-law shot.
It was one of those things that
a domestic, unfortunate. Domestic
just
problem.
Domestic, just happened after a party. And,
that's okay. I just wanted to be sure there was no racism involved.
No, it wasn't.
Yeah, okay.
It was
okay.
Brother to brother, brother-in-law.
Okay.
And
okay.
Two sisters.
Did your parents feel like you were properly protected by the law? I mean,
We were law-abiding citizens.
As long as you were law-abiding, you're okay.
And there were some roughnecks. Son, don't stand over me, you're disturbing me, okay? If you want to be out, come sit down. If you weren't law-abiding, and I wasn't afraid by no means, but
yeah.
I always said if you stay in your place,
you're okay.
That's right. I didn't have to go outside of my place, you know, to be happy.
That's right. Okay.
See what I'm talking about?
Okay. Yeah. Well, from a law standpoint, was this the era of Sheriff Youngblood?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
Can you describe him as to how blacks felt about him? Was he fair to blacks or not fair?
Brian, when people do wrong, and they get caught. They want as much mercy as they can get. and that you wasn't going to get from Youngblood.
Sheriff Youngblood, okay.
He's going to be fair. It was just it. That's just the way it was.
Yeah.
And he was rough.
Okay.
It was rough.
Did he treat the whites the same way?
They are, I can say this, that I know of some whites that would speak of him in a very derogatory, has spoken of him in a very derogatory way.
Yeah, okay.
And he just didn't play. He was rough.
Okay.
And if you got in his way, white or black, you know, you paid the consequences for it.
So is that a fair way to describe him? He just upheld what he thought was the law?
I'm sure that there was some prejudice in him.
Yeah.
And I knew, I dealt, and here again, Brian and I, you'll find me a little very modest, but there was something about me that God gave me that I could appease anybody that I come in contact with and not suck up to him.
Yeah, okay.
And what I'm trying to say now, like his brother ran the Gulf Station up there, Youngblood brother,
okay,
ran the Gulf Station up there. Wait, I don't know where the Topsy still run that one now, right at the red
he
light.
He sold it right there by St. Peter's.
St. Peter's, uh-huh.
Yeah, okay.
Right across from First
okay.
Federal Savings.
Yeah.
He used to run that.
Okay.
And I'd go by, hey, Mr. Youngblood, how you doing? Hey, boy, how you doing?
Yeah.
Others go by, get your so-and-so off my property.
Yeah,
you know?
Okay. Okay. Okay.
James?
He's right there.
Check outside.
Okay.
But that, things like that, and I could handle that.
Yeah, okay.
You see?
Yeah, okay. There we are. We got the furniture then. We're back in business again. I'd heard several people say that Sheriff Youngblood was kind of tough on the women.
Yes.
He wanted to talk to you about something. We're back.
Now, he was rough. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
Like I said, that if you never had any problem with him.
Yeah. He was rough with everybody as opposed
just
to just...
rough. He was rough. But blacks, of course, the people who came in from Jacksonville gave him the worst name.
Yeah, I see.
You see them down my
Yeah, okay.
Because they were tough on him. But no, his staff was tough on him.
Yeah, okay.
And you had your black deputies. Ben Session, you had Telfair. You had the black deputies back there during that time. You had Jerry, one of them got killed. One of his deputies got killed.
Okay. It was good for blacks to have black deputies.
Oh, yes. And they gained the same nature.
Yeah,
that Youngblood had.
Yeah, okay.
Until Youngblood moved off the scene.
I see.
And Ben had to live it down. Terfair got sick. He lived it down too.
Okay.
But and Jerry got killed in action over there on the beach in Ferdinand.
Oh, okay. All right.
But generally, he liked compassion.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way.
Okay.
He didn't. Can't say no man likes compassion. Just didn't show compassion.
Just didn't show it. Okay. Yeah. All right.
It was. I'm Youngblood, and I kick you. I'm supposed to kick your butt. Youngblood's supposed to kick your butt.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. How about you? Could you? Did we talk about? Can your both your stepfather and mother read? Your stepfather taught himself to read.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
He's very.
Okay. All right.
Well.
Hey, we're back in business. Did you have a lot of friends when you were a young man?
Oh, yes. Always had some friends.
Can you describe your best friends and how many of them were white?
During the time, my black friends were Joe Richardson and Willie Brown. Those were the two best. We were classmates. Joe and his wife just celebrated the 50th anniversary here. In January. Willie is an attorney at law in Washington and D.C. I had black friends like back there during that time, being an athlete, I was very into sports. And you know where that ballpark is now?
Yes.
That used to be a wooden fence there.
Okay.
And then further down, there's a group of clustered trees. And we used to have to climb up in the trees to look over in there to see the baseball game.
I see, okay.
We had trees where we took boards up into the tree and nailed the boards down so we could have a seat.
Okay.
The Keglers lived right there on the corner. They had an upstairs house there, and on the corner division, and Henry and them on the side there.
Okay.
We'd go down there sometime,
This was a black family.
A black family, yes.
Okay.
And we used to go up and look over into the field and look at the white ball game.
Okay.
And of course, wherever there was a plank out, we could peep, and the old knothole we could peep.
Okay.
Then the football, when the high school had football long before Peg did, you had guys like Dr. Wesley, Larry Wesley, Bull York, the Guthries, the Burbank boys, all those, and we would see each other on the streets. I would see him,
right? Yeah, okay.
And I would always tell, hey man, did a good job, you know, and it wasn't, and that's the way it was. Now, coming to Callahan was and then like I said, everybody knew my family. The Coakley family was a permanent family.
Yeah, okay.
Bubba and Uncle Richard. Uncle Richard worked downtown at the Haddock Barbershop.
Okay.
He used to be the shoeshine boy down there.
Okay.
Then I had cousin McKeever worked at the Livingston's Tobacco Store.
McKeever?
McKeever, yes.
How you spell that?
McKeever.
Okay.
Keever.
Okay.
He used to work at the Livingston Tobacco Store, and he used to go along with his bicycle with the basket on and delivering cigarettes to the little mom and pop stores around. And Uncle Richard shined his shoes at the Haddock Barbershop. Then he got transferred. Well, he got a job at the post office. So he and Uncle Bubba was at the post office. And cousin Bubba and Uncle Richard, that's the way it was.
Okay.
Bubba was my cousin. His name was Emmett L. and mine was Emmett G. Copeland.
Okay.
But when I went downtown, the people that they knew, I began to know, you see.
Okay.
And so my relationship developed like that, and I was always, you know, cordial.
Okay.
I wasn't afraid to go and ask if I wanted something, or if you need some work or something like that.
Did you ever play games, kids games with the white kids?
Not really.
Okay.
Not really.
Let me try to tie something together here. You know Jackie Delaney?
Yeah, Jackie, huh?
Jackie talked about whenever they needed a new baseball, they'd wait on the other side of the fence till somebody hit a home run, they'd grab the ball and run.
That's right.
Because the balls were all worn out, etc.
That's
right. But Jackie mentioned, I don't know where they played baseball, but they did play baseball with some white kids, and it seemed like whenever they did that, it was the best players got together, whether they were black or white. Do you remember any of that?
Vaguely, I remember, vaguely.
You weren't a part of that.
Yeah, no, I wasn't a part of that. Yeah. Jack is a little older.
Kids that you'd like to see once in a while, or you'd meet at the movies, or went swimming with, or...
No, that wasn't, in 50, that wasn't my...
That didn't fit.
No, it didn't fit, because see, the pool's right there, in 50.
Yeah, okay. All right.
Pool's right there.
As a kid, did you ever get into any real mischief?
No.
Just kid stuff?
Just kid stuff.
Yeah, okay.
Never remember stealing anything other than watermelons and peaches and kumquats and grapes, you know, sugar cane.
I was talking to Lovett the other day, as you know, and he talked about...
Lovett stole the cows?
Well, he didn't. He talked about swimming in the swamp over here and setting the forest on fire.
Yeah.
All that kind of. You didn't get into any of that stuff.
He was along with Lovett was with my first wife. So that was before I came to Callahan.
Okay.
So I married Lovett's first cousin.
Okay.
To a sister brother's children.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have to think about all that to put it all.
But they stole some cows too. Yeah.
Stole tiles.
Cows.
Cows. Okay. Oh yeah, he told me about burying one.
Yeah. They did some everything. There was a little rowdy group. There was that Callahan group.
Yeah. What did you learn about slavery and those kinds of things when you were a kid? Did you know much about some of these things that happened?
No, just you know, more than what you. I really didn't.
Yeah, okay.
Really didn't.
How about school? Did they teach you about what happened during the slave period? Any of these kinds of things?
Very little.
Very little.
Okay. Yeah.
As an educator, was there a reason for that? Did they just not know, or did they not want to bring up the unpleasantness?
They didn't want to bring up the unpleasantness.
Yeah.
And they still don't want to bring it up.
Yeah.
They don't want the kids that are able, the white kid who's able to think for himself now, they don't want him to really know that.
Yeah.
They still have big issues about Black History Month, but I'm not an advocate of Black History Month.
Could you tell me why?
I'm an advocate of Black History every day.
Yeah, okay.
It should be integrated into all of the history books.
Just not one month.
Just one month.
Yeah, okay.
I think, you ain't celebrate Dr. King's birthday like you do Washington, Lincoln,
yeah,
and any other incident,
yeah,
if you want to, you know, and they do it nationally on a national basis. You can do like, if you didn't know it, the National Women's Month, you know, if you didn't know that, if somebody wasn't advocating that and pushing it, you wouldn't know they had a month, you know. But I think it should be integrated into all of the textbooks, and it's not only American history, it's world history.
I agree with you, I was rather surprised when you said they didn't talk too much about these things in school.
It was there, you know, you read the little picture, you saw the old slave picture, typical picture. Now they're more graphic now. And your reference books are more detailed. And some of the stories that you read, you'd be surprised.
Yeah.
As you, I did a little sketch, for the Cub Scouts sometime. It was a little while ago, and I did a little research about it. They wanted to, it was just predominantly white pack, and they wanted to know a little bit about the Afro-American history, and I did some things and shared it with them, and they was kind of surprised. There's a lot that we played some important roles.
Very important. Very important.
That the general public is not aware of.
Yeah.
And like unless
the,
you
like the Tuskegee Airmen.
Right. That's right. Yeah. That's right. And there are so many things that we had to do. And when you look back at the general, some of the accomplishments of the blacks, there are a whole lot of blacks that don't know that.
Yeah, that's a
and
shame.
And that's because it's suppressed into black history. When you get into black history, there's not enough time.
Yeah.
But if it was on a daily basis, when you start getting to that part of your history talking about inventions, then the list should be there on and on and on.
Yeah.
You know, not to pick it out and put it on this side over here for black history.
Yeah.
Sam.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why I'm doing this, is just get people to talk.
Yeah.
And you know, I'd be very honest with you and say some of the people I've talked to have been very reluctant to talk about unpleasant things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe it's because I'm white. I don't know, but I spent some time before we got started letting you know why I'm interested
in all
of this, which I think is helpful for a black person to know when they talk to a white person like this, but I find some general reluctance. In fact, I was talking to a university professor not long ago who said that he is able to find out more about black oral history by sending a black person to talk to a black person.
Right. Well, this is probably true. There's something that's going to always be there. There are blacks who've never had an encounter with a white, been able to get any form of security they want, get anything that they want, and never had a conflict with a black, but they still have that hatred. With a white, still have that hatred in there. Not because of what they've done to them, but for what they've done to others. And they're not letting bygones be bygones.
Yeah.
And that's why you run into that reluctancy that they just, it's just subsided. None of your business.
Yeah. And I can understand that, so I work hard to see if I can't work my way through that, because I'm a believer that if somebody has hurt in them...
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Just hit that.
Okay, we'll go ahead. I've forgotten the point I was
doing. Well, we were talking about the reluctance of people to talk to you.
Yes, and that's why I spend some time having people understand me a little bit, so where I'm coming from would help with... This one professor told me that he found he gained more knowledge from black history and oral interviews if he had a black person go and visit, and I think I can understand that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But okay. Let me see what else I have here. Really not an awful lot that I haven't already asked you. Can you tell me a little bit about when you were married, a little bit about your wife?
My first wife, I came to Callahan in 1954. I was engaged to marry a young lady in Jacksonville. And it just happened, I met this lady here, and I got drafted. I came here in September 54, went back to Ferndina for the Christmas holidays, and when I got there, my greetings paper was there. So I got drafted, then I never did come back to work that year, '55. I went into the military, and I got out on early release at the December of 57. And was very fortunate, came right back, and a lady was out on sick leave, and the school opened just like I went to the military from the Christmas holidays. When I came back, I went back to work after Christmas holidays from the military. So I didn't spend but 2 weeks out of the military without having to work. And I worked 36 years from that day on, and I met this young lady, and we married. That's the old homestead over there. I love it, tore down the old, her daddy's home over there. And I don't know what my brother-in-law was going to do with it, but he did tear it down. But that's where my wife lived, and we rented a home over here on the next street for a while, and we built this home out here. And I think it was 74, we built this home here. And we had one child. She had a very big family. She had 10 brothers and sisters at the time I met her, but now only one brother's living.
I see.
And she was working at the egg plant where they used to grade eggs, kennel eggs, and she finally got into the school system as a secretary. She'd had some bookkeeping. She finally got into school as a secretary, so we worked at the same school for a long period of time.
Okay.
Then she got transferred to the school board in Ferndina, where she worked as a secretary to the special programs.
Okay.
And that's where she retired from. She retired in 77 because she had a open heart surgery. She had a full bypass and a valve. And she retired and didn't go back to work from that. And so in 84, she was had a bout with cancer, and she had a treatment for that, and she, that seemed to be doing, everything was doing well.
Mm-hmm.
She went to a cardiologist. Her brother was going to take her to Hawaii with him. He was the union president for the Postal Service.
Oh, okay.
And he was going to take her with him. And she was getting a little business all straight with the doctors and all. And her cardiologist told her she was all right to go. She didn't need to come back there for 6 months. And the gynecologist told her that 6 months, come back 6 months. And she did all she was getting prepared to go. She was a mistress of ceremony of a program at a church over here. And she got ready to get up to take the chair to be the MC, and was singing a song. And so she would turn around and sit down in a chair like this and just sit and just slip right down to the floor. And of course, other than my son and I, later on at the hospital, talked about it. When she left here, they air flighted her from here, but she was brain damaged, and we agreed it was no need of prolonging that, because you're going in to see treatment.
Yeah.
But anyway, we had a very lovely life together, and she was, she just had one of the largest funerals that ever was had. If not larger than the Blues family that just recently had one. But she was loved by her. I think we had something like 122 bouquets of flowers, 130-some cards and telegrams, and it was had to repass at the middle school after the.
Okay. Yeah.
Because it was that she was that respect, you know, yeah. that's the kind of person she was.
Yeah.
And I got a lot of strength from her. I used to tell her, hey, I saw her brass shining.
Yeah.
I got to go back and give you some brass so it shined yeah. my brass.
She went through a lot and she handled it.
She really did.
Yeah.
She really did.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
And in addition, going through with me too.
Yeah. Well, I got one final question for you, and that is there a difference between the eastern part of Nassau County and the western part of Nassau County as the way blacks got along with whites? And
it is. It's a definite difference.
Talking a little bit about the differences between eastern and western.
There's a difference, and it's not one better than the other. It's just that that's the way it happened.
Can you describe the differences?
Callahan, basically, Ferdina, we look at the surface, the surf nuts, that, you know.
Yeah.
And then we the hicks over here, and hicks. But Jacksonville, and then there's a greater difference than the ones who live in Callahan and Hilliard. Now, we tried consolidating the school at Hilliard here, but but the lifestyles were so different, even though they're only 12 miles apart. All right, Callahan relies on Jacksonville for many of the jobs, and that's where we do all our shopping. So we're into the city.
Okay.
And then you had the migration of people from the city. Integration sent those people who live on the northernmost part of Jacksonville into Callahan.
I see.
That's how Callahan exploded. Nothing but integration. Sherwood Forest, which was a predominantly white area. Those, when the blacks could buy homes in there, the whites moved out. And that's where they moved out here. Ironically enough, they were willing to leave schools like Rebalt and Raines to come to a school like West Nassau with a black principal.
Okay.
Which I was the black principal.
Yeah, yeah,
see what I'm talking
yeah,
about?
Right.
And, but that's what happened. And what I'm trying to say is that the local people in the Callahan area, it's got a little bit of the city life they live. And they come back and they live to enjoy the country.
Just both black and white?
Yeah, both black and white.
Okay.
Yeah, both
okay.
black and white.
How would you compare the blacks in here and the blacks in Fernandina as far as their lifestyles and
like I said, we're out.
Yeah.
I don't want to use the word country. But we draw the freedom of the space.
Yeah, I'm comfortable with that.
Freedom of space.
Yes, okay.
We enjoy the freedom of space. In Fernandina, you don't have the space.
Okay.
That's why I'm still out here.
Yeah, okay.
Because I enjoy the freedom of space. I enjoy out here.
Okay.
See, if you hadn't come today and Bridget and that, y'all, I'm blessed today, man. I had three people come down my road today. Normally on Thursday, nobody comes down there but Bridget, see?
Yeah, okay.
I'm really blessed to have it. But see, in Fernandina, that crowdedness, I don't know. But far as you got the mills, that's their livelihood. So then you still have people who commute to Jacksonville to work.
Okay.
But you got the mills and the Mealon plantation. You got your work. They work right there. The workforce is right in that area.
Yeah.
See, well, we have to go to Jacksonville
to work.
Bridget comes from Folkestone down here to work. See?
Okay, I got you.
My wife works in Jacksonville.
Okay,
right.
This is a more rural area.
That's right.
How does Hilliard fit in that?
Hilliard is rural, but I really can't describe that there's a difference.
It's
they can't
okay.
get along.
Okay.
But we just recently learned how to play basketball and football together
okay.
without fighting.
Okay. Okay.
And it's not because of whether you're black or white, because you see the black kids from the King Ferry and Hilliard area came into Callahan up until 1968. You see?
Okay, I got you.
All the black kids in the Callahan, the King Ferry, Leslie, Sand Hill, Hilliard area came into here.
Okay.
This school you see over here used to be Pine Forest Community School.
Okay.
And it served the people from King Ferry, Hilliard, and Callahan.
Okay.
All right.
I get you.
Then in 1968, this school became, that school, the old Pine Forest School, which is the black school, became the junior high school. And
for both races?
For both races.
Yeah,
it was totally integrated.
Yeah, okay.
West Nassau was integrated in 1962.
Okay.
And that's when it first started. And in 1976, March 1976, I was transferred. In 1968, I was appointed assistant principal at the Callahan Junior High School, which was at this location here.
Okay.
Then 4 years later, I was appointed the principal of the junior high school.
Okay.
So I became the first
black
junior high school principal.
Yeah. Okay.
Then in March of 76, I got transferred to the high school and became the first black high school principal.
Okay.
Uniqueness about it, you talk about integration and talk about the people. You had Joe Mosier, white, who owned the cleaners. It used to be located right down in here,
okay,
where the Farm Bureau is now.
Okay.
You had Lloyd Herring, who operated the printing company.
Herring, H-E-R-R-I-N-G? Okay.
S-I-N.
Oh, Herring, okay. Mm-hmm.
And he ran that. You had John Douglas, who had the barber shop up here, which was a white barber shop.
Okay.
John Douglas and Joe Mosier and Herring, these are people who had that labor just hard, so they didn't have nothing for blacks. Okay?
Okay.
That's just the way it was.
Yeah, okay.
I sat down at Herring's table and had coffee with him because I knew how to get to him.
Yeah, okay.
He wanted my business at the school. I was giving it to him.
Yeah, okay.
And he respected me.
Yeah, okay.
Joe Mosier down at the laundry respected me.
Okay.
John Douglas at the barbershop respected me.
Okay.
The day that we integrated this junior high school here,
okay,
they came to me and told me that if I needed them to come out, they would come out.
Wonderful.
Success.
You mentioned barbershop. I've got a question. Have you ever seen a black person in a white barbershop?
Here?
Yeah.
No,
just something that doesn't happen.
Now, we're the only black barbershop, the only barber, but there's only one uptown.
Okay.
And the black barbershop we got here is a retired assistant principal from Fernie Beach High School, Thomas Blue.
Okay.
He's been cutting my hair for almost 40 years, and
okay,
he cut it at his home.
Okay.
That's where the barbershop is.
Okay.
And that's traditionally. Now, we branch out. We do have, we go to the beauty parlors now. Males go to beauty parlors and have the ladies cut their hair.
Okay,
now.
That would be a beauty parlor with blacks and white ladies?
Right, it could
okay
easily be that now.
Okay, okay.
But not here in Callahan, but in Jacksonville.
Yeah, okay.
And it may be up over here, up in the Folkston area up there,
yeah,
but
okay,
not here in Callahan.
Okay, so it's starting to happen.
Oh, yeah, it's starting to happen.
That was an incidental question.
It's a good question. And there's some things you just don't know. There are some places, Brian, here in Callahan I've never been in. I never want to go in.
Yeah, okay.
You see what I'm talking about?
Because you feel there's a prejudice.
I don't have any need for it.
Okay.
If I don't have any need for it, I don't just go there just to go,
Yeah, okay. Okay.
And yet, there were times there was no place in Callahan that I couldn't go.
Yes, okay.
I just didn't go.
Okay.
I remember well the package stores, that one side on the side, you go on the side, and the traveling, the inside, the jukebox is gone, everybody having a good time, you come on outside to the window, get your package and go on about your business.
Yeah. Yeah.
That did change down here, the Playbill down here, but then you weren't welcome in there, so then too many people didn't go in there.
Didn't go, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now they hung around on the outside.
Okay.
Yeah.
I got another incidental question to you. I can remember you mentioned American Beach, which brought a thought forward. One lady I talked to originally lived in Jacksonville, and they used to come to American Beach on weekends and enjoy themselves and then go back to Jacksonville. But she told me that her family had a great fear of coming up 17 through Yulee and across to Fernandina, that area maybe just south of Yulee on 17 and maybe Yulee, and then maybe outside of Yulee for a while. They were terribly frightened. Her father used to say, you know, go to the bathroom, we'll check the gas. They didn't want to stop a lot.
Oh, yeah, no.
Was that a particularly tough area that you remember?
Just wasn't any place known there to go.
Okay.
See, just wasn't anything
and
there.
That's what made it tough, because there was nothing
tough.
There.
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
Made it tough, because you didn't have any place to go except in the bushes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and then you carried your toilet paper with you.
Yeah, okay.
And you mentioned that just incidental things, you know, that in traveling, you know, for us, you know, we had to fry some chicken and make some sandwiches and boil some eggs and get a shoebox like that box you got there and pack our lunch.
Yeah.
Because there wasn't no place to start.
Yeah, okay.
And like you said, boy, you better be sure you can hold it where you're going.
That's what you used to say.
Yeah, yeah, because if you don't, I think that when you look back, what integration really meant, I'm going to drop this one on you. You didn't ask it, so I was hoping you'd get around to it.
Okay, well, that's good.
Mark Johnson was the first person that approached me about school, with instrumentals in school. He's white.
Okay.
He lived out here on the Musselwhite Road. Mark was a very educated person, and he knew the value of a good education. And he would, from his friends, when black schools, we didn't get subscriptions like we can get now for the library.
Yeah.
But he would bring all his books to the school, to the library, which was very helpful. He did that. And this was about this time to begin to talk about the integration. He asked me, what did I think of it? And I surprised him. I said, Mark, I said, I don't think very much of it. He said, what is it? I said, I have a problem. I said, as an educator, what a student learns from a book is fine. But what he learns socially is equally important. You're going to take me across the track. And this is what it was. You've been taking them from this school here across the track uptown for integration. Then you're going to bring me on a bus and you're going to bring him back in my environment. I saw some things today from my white friends. You understand what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do.
I saw some things. I heard some things about social things that don't even fit into my life. I still got to compete. But what is sociably accepted and what is not.
Yes.
And that was my, I told him, he said, well, I guess you got something there.
Yeah.
And I said, but now, if the schools were equal, and the equipment was equal, and the teachers' knowledge and ability was equal, I wouldn't care whether you integrated or not.
Yeah.
All right, now, that's where school, and here's where I felt about it. When they closed down Pine Forest, grades 1 through 12.
Which was all black.
All black.
Yeah, okay.
We took away, for each class, if there was five, if each class was organized with class officers, president, vice president, secretary, business manager, treasurer, parliamentarian, say five minimum, and there were others. Each class, five, had five, and you had 12. That represent that number of black kids that would have had some kind of status in an organization as a president, vice president, secretary. They were getting some kind of leadership training.
Yeah.
But when and these are elected positions. They were still elected because their peers had threat. But when you go into the white part where they're a minority, this boy here have six classes all day long. There's only two black kids in his class.
Yeah.
And that group these in too.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. But when we integrated, the chance of that kid has got to be exceptionally good to get to be the president of the student council.
Well, his chances are less.
It's less.
You're
that's right. It's less.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that.
Right. I got 100 black musicians. I integrate. I got five.
Yeah. Yeah, I see.
You see what I'm talking about?
Yes,
you got to go uptown at a time and practice. Mom and daddy can't provide the transportation for them.
Yeah.
See what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do.
This is the things that happened to us. Now, that's that part where you look at the school. Now, I'm going to be the first to admit that, yes, the facilities were better. They did have a better chance to learn.
Yeah.
But when they left out of that environment, it's different now. This is when it did. This is when I was first looking at it. I see it a little different now.
Yeah, I see.
But it still didn't change that status about the number of possible leaders we could have developed in our school as compared to the ones we have now.
Yeah.
We don't even go in athletics because if you're good, you're good.
There are some people that are properly looking at this concept that maybe there are some features of integration that have hurt players.
Right.
I can see that.
Now, what kicked that in was this. We were talking about the box of food, preparing our food.
Yeah.
That's where integration plays a role in my life. I have that joy of going out, picking up this phone, or go to that computer, register my room in California, Europe, or somewhere.
Yeah, that's right.
Get my airline and go and fly, or I can plan my map along that I want to stop.
You can
at
stop
the Jiffy food store in Folkestone and urinate.
Yeah,
you see what I'm talking
about?
That's
right. Yes. Yeah.
That's the joy that I have.
Yeah.
I have the joy that any store down here that I want to go, I can go in and spend my money.
Yeah.
And get what I want.
Yeah.
Another view that you don't see. That when we talk about integration, you can right here in Callahan. Why? There is not a black store in Callahan that I can go buy a loaf of bread from. There's not one place in Callahan that a black can go buy a loaf of bread from. Matter of fact, there ain't too many places to go buy anything, if anything. Well, there's not.
Yeah.
Well, the washing mat down there is owned by blacks down here in the Winn-Dixie Plaza.
Yeah.
Blacks own that. Then there's a few beauty salons around.
You know, I think of the Afro-American Insurance Company, for example. Once integration came along, many of those good black businesses just disappeared because they lost their market.
That's right.
Yeah. So
that's
you're right.
Right.
There's
but now, here it is. And American Beach property owners wouldn't agree with when I say this, but I don't care too much for them anyway. They did not have a good handle on business sense when they started out.
Yeah.
Fine, you can't sell hot dogs, hamburgers, and fish sandwiches and put that money in your pocket.
Yes, I do.
You got to sell hot dogs, hamburgers, and fish, and if it costs you $50 to get that material and sell that fish and you made $100, you put that $50 away and put that $50 back into the business.
That's right.
You don't take that
$100 and
spend it.
Yeah.
See what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
And that's where they went wrong.
I think the other thing that we're talking straight here.
Yeah.
And we have been all day. But the other thing that bothers
me. We're down to the nitty gritty now.
The other thing that bothers me about American Beach is the folks haven't kept up their property over there.
That's right.
It looks like a storm went through there.
I know. This is what I'm talking about.
And I've talked to some good black folks over there saying, what can we do to get these folks to paint their porch and fix a garage door and where somebody punched a hole in a window, put a new pane of glass in there, make it look like it's home instead of a disaster area.
You're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
So these are some of the things that we'll will happen.
But it's I've carried myself in a way that I give respect because I demand respect.
Yeah. I see your stepfather coming out in all of this.
He
had quite an impact on your life.
Yeah, he sure had it. He really did.
And that's what you're trying to do with young James.
Right. That's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
And like I said, I've had a pleasant, I went into the integrated situations. That's what it was all about. They integrated them and I went in.
Yeah.
And I had a group.
Yeah.
That, weren't organized.
Yeah.
Group of blacks wanted to be organized, be standing over there on my corner just in case I needed.
Yeah. Yeah.
I told myself I don't need that.
Yeah, I understand.
I don't need that. I'm a God fearing man. All this became available because of God, and I'm taking him with me. He's already over there, so he's available for me now.
That's right.
And I had a successful, I had one incident that was vandalism on an El Camino I had, and it happened at a basketball game. And the daddy found out that his son did it.
But white,
full white.
White.
Yeah. But there was, I knew the boy, he knew me.
Yeah.
And it was kind of, it made me feel good after it was all done, because the daddy did put me four new tires on there.
Uh-huh.
The tires were salvageable, but he put four on there.
Yeah.
And made that boy work and pay for them. What happened was, you just don't do this to Mr. Copley Carr.
Yeah, yeah.
He took a deer. The boy dared him to do it.
Yeah.
And he did it.
Yeah.
And I said, in a way, when I look at it, I said, now, you know, that's not bad after all.
He learned something.
That's right. Other kids Father. Knew that yeah. you weren't supposed to do this to Mr.
Yeah.
Copley's car.
Yeah. Yeah. Or anybody's car.
Any car.
Yeah.
But at least Mr. Copley didn't deserve
yeah.
this.
Yeah.
But just to show his peers, and he that little fellow came to me, boy, and I just surprised him, Brian. This is the way I used to do fight. This is the way I used to fight.
Yeah.
When I say fight, this is where I used to fight him.
I understand.
And just destroy him. He thought, sure, I was going to say something to him in a derogatory way, and he
yeah.
come to me, I'm sorry about the car. I walked up to him.
Yeah.
Put my arms around
him. Yeah. That's what you're doing with this young lad
yeah.
here. I can see it.
Yeah.
I can see well, you're talking to him.
Yeah, well, I got
well,
my
you,
work cut out.
Yeah, well, that's okay, but there's possibility of enhancing his life.
Oh,
and
it's
you
hope,
can't
yeah.
quit. Yeah,
yeah,
I think
it's hope.
Well, I take my hat off to you.
Mentioning
him, let's get him back in
okay.
here. We've got the recorder on, James, and you were nice enough to sit and listen to most of what we talked about here, and we ask you to write down any questions you might have. Okay. Why don't you, you want us to wait for you?
No, go ahead.
Okay.
He can handle himself.
Why don't you ask the question, first question, what is it?
I wanted to know, what did my daddy and mama do for a job?
Okay. Well, we better wait till he gets back and let him answer that for you, okay? Back on again. You want to ask your question one more time now?
What did your mama do for a job to get her money?
Mama Dolly?
Mm-hmm.
Mama Dolly washed clothes. Iron clothes. She went into the homes and did domestic work. She went into the white folks' homes and washed. Come home with her knuckles all sore, you know. Because that was the best way she could do it. And she started, got a job in the cafeteria. And she made cakes for a while and sold them. But then she gave away more cakes than she was selling. So she started just giving them away, making everybody. Mama Dolly make your cakes, so she making some people would always give her something back for what she put into it.
Say Mama Dolly, D-O-L-L-Y?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay.
Papa Joe and Mama Dolly.
Okay. Now what you, is that
And you see, the thing you should get about that is that you have an opportunity now to prepare yourself so you won't have to do that kind of work. But you sometime, and I don't understand why, the thing that, and Mr. Brian can tell you that you can't get anything being disobedient.
That's correct.
While we were out here, Brian, he's back there being disobedient. He knows he's not supposed to watch the television. He knows that.
That's an important lesson to learn in life, that you have to pay attention.
And the reason why he's home today is because he's disobedient.
I see.
And
well,
that's his biggest problem. He's just absolutely disobedient. I don't care if there's nothing, all words, physical punishment, taking away television, everything. He just won't be obedient.
Are you going to try and not be disobedient in the future? You have to try. It may be hard for you, but it's something you can try. Let's ask you the second question.
How did you become principal of West Nassau?
First of all, being obedient. That's how. Being obedient, and my becoming principal of West Nassau was my school day boyhood dream. I always wanted to be a principal. And I worked hard at it. I kept my eyes open, my ears open. I learned. I was patient. Above all, I was obedient. And I gave respect. That's how I got to be.
Those are important things to think about.
And of course, my education I had. Papa Joe gave me a good shove. And once he got me started, I was off and running. I got my master's degree. I left here, went to Tallahassee. I used to leave here at 2:30 in the afternoon, drive to Tallahassee, go to class at 6 o'clock, get out of class at 9, made arrangements with the Kentucky Fried Place up there in Tallahassee that whatever they had left over, they'd have it in a box that would constitute a dinner. Stop by, even though sometimes they'd be clothes cleaning, and they'd have a drink out of the machine, give them a drink in a box, and I would pay them for it. I knew it was going to be $5, so it didn't make no difference what it was. Have that already handed, get in the car and come on back to Callahan. Get up the next morning, go to work. Get up on Saturday morning, 5:30 in the morning, drive to Tallahassee, be the class at 8:30. Drive back. That's how I got my master's, in order to certify me to be an administrator and a supervisor.
Anything that's good in life, you have to work for it, right? No, that's good. That's good advice.
But Brian, out of all the things, if I had one character trait that I would treasure most of all, is that I was trustworthy.
Yeah.
I was trustworthy.
Yeah.
And people trusted me.
Yeah.
And when they trusted me, it allowed me the freedom to do some of the things that I wanted to do without being under pressure.
That's terribly important to remember, James.
Somebody can trust you.
Yeah.
Now, if your daddy can't trust you sitting here, he in the den, he in the back, what the hell can I trust him outside
with? That's right.
How can I trust him on the lawnmower?
Yeah.
How can I trust him out to the basketball court out here where they're playing? Can't do it.
These are things to think about, James, and you're young enough to be sure that you learn those lessons, and everybody can trust you, and you're obedient, and then you can be successful, and you can be a school principal or an airline pilot or a minister or whatever you might want to be.
He wants to be the President of the United States.
Well, that's wonderful.
There's no reason why he can't be it.
Everybody in our country has that chance, but they have to work for it.
And like I told him, I'm trying to live the kind of life so that when he does get to be President of the United States, when they do a background check, they won't be the thing to keep you from getting the presidency.
That's right. That's right. Okay. Does that answer your questions all right?
And well, you go back and move your stuff out.